March 22, 2010. This is the Migration Policy Institute speaker series, Leadership Visions, and today's guest is U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services Director Alejandro Mayorkas, giving his vision for the future of his agency. Today's event is moderated by Doris Meisner, Senior Fellow and Director of the U.S. Immigration Policy Program at the Migration Policy Institute.
So, today, our format is going to be the format that we used before, which is that our guest, Director Alejandro Mayorkas of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, will make opening remarks, and he's going to try to do his opening remarks away from the rigidity of the podium. But this is an experiment, and so you need to tell us if you can hear. He's got a lavalier mic, but if for some reason it's not picking up, he will come behind the podium, but that's not the preference this morning, so we're going to try to do a little bit more freeform. And then he's going to join me on the risers again, and he and I will have a conversation for a while about some of the issues that I'd like to draw out a little more fully or things that perhaps he hasn't had a chance to touch on. And then we'll open to the audience for Q&A for the rest of the time. Now, you have the bio on your sheet, so you have the bio sheet on your seats, so I won't go through it here. Except to say that Director Mayorkas has a legal background and has spent a substantial time of his career in federal service, so he has a public service background. And in addition to that, a very compelling personal story and acquaintance with immigration. So it's a very good combination for this position. In addition to that, I think I would like to say at the outset in starting this off that, as most of you know, the agency that he heads, the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, is a relatively new agency. It was created as part of the Department of Homeland Security with the breakup of the Immigration and Naturalization Service. I think it is fair to say that it has been less visible over the course of its young life than its counterpart agencies, ICE or CBP, and it is considerably smaller than those companion agencies, both in personnel and in resources. But it has a very large mission, and that is, of course, an essential mission because it is the mission of administering the nation's legal immigration system. So as such, Alejandro Mayorkas, Ali, is the steward of programs that really continue to represent enormous hope, aspiration, inspiration, idealism for millions around the world. In addition to that, if the day ever comes where we have substantial new legislation that is anywhere along the lines of the way in which comprehensive immigration reform has been described and is being talked about today, then that agency, USCIS, will actually take on and be charged with the central mandates of a new law. This is always, I think, slightly counterintuitive because we talk about the new law as a response to a dysfunctional system, which of course it certainly is, and as heavily involved with enforcement of one sort or another, which certainly is the case. But if you think about it, a number of the pillars of a new law, first of all, mandatory employer verification, would, to a considerable extent, be the next generation of one form or another of what is today E-Verify, which is administered at USCIS. The new law would most likely involve some form or another of future flows to meet labor force needs in this country, whether that be through temporary programs, through combination of temporary permanent programs, whether it is increased legal immigration for employment purposes. But any form of those kinds of future flows would in fact principally involve USCIS and the approval of petitions for those slots. And then finally, of course, the thing that we know well if there is a legalization program of some kind, we would be talking about the possible conferring of legal status on 11 million. It would depend, of course, how it's written and what the numbers are at that time. But still, I think it's fair to say a larger caseload of adjudications than has ever been handled by the agency to date, on top of its ongoing caseload. So this is an extraordinarily important agency with varied missions that are incredibly important in their current formulation as well as in what the future might hold. Thus, it's critical that it be an important, that it be a strong and effective agency. So, Ali Mayorkas is here to that end, to tell us about the agency, to describe his plans for the agency. And I would like to say in closing and in welcoming him that he and I have only become recently acquainted, but it's been a very, very nice acquaintanceship. And it's one in which I have found him to be a very thoughtful, deeply compassionate, and quite independent-minded administrator. So with that, let me say, Ali, welcome, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Doris. When I was in my 20s, I was a young lawyer in Los Angeles, and I had the occasion to visit my great aunt and uncle in Brooklyn, New York. I come from a very, very small family. And I visited their apartment in Brooklyn, and for them to have a visitor, let alone a family visitor, was regrettably not that common an occurrence. And I recall all of the planning that went into a family visit, and I remember having lunch with them in their very small apartment on Albemarle. And for lunch, we had something that to which I was quite unaccustomed, which was a little white wine with sparkling water as a beverage to get the day going, and also a small sandwich. And the sandwich was wrapped in wax paper. And we enjoyed each other's company a great deal. Come from a very close family as well as a small one. And after lunch, I recall crumpling up the piece of wax paper to throw it out, as I thought would be customary and appropriate. And I remember my great aunt looking at me with, I'm not sure if it was something between disdain and horror, that I had the insensitivity to throw out something that could be saved and used another day. And sure enough, she flattened that wax paper, that piece of wax paper that I had crumpled together. She had flattened it and ironed it very carefully with her hand. And lo and behold, it was a very neatly small cut square of wax paper. And she placed it on top of the refrigerator, on top of a nice stack of neatly cut wax paper squares to be used again. And my great aunt and her husband, my great uncle, came with my parents, my sister, and I to this country in 1960 as refugees from Cuba. And when I was being prepared and preparing to take the leadership of United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, the first people of whom I thought were indeed my great aunt and uncle. And I thought specifically of that experience of having lunch with them and of what my great aunt did with that wax paper square. Because we as an agency, the money that we spend predominantly is the money that my great aunt saved in order to afford a benefit to which she was entitled. And when I think of our operations and our ability to serve an immigrant population or a population here, a constituency in the public domain that seeks to avail itself of immigration benefits that we administer, I think of my great aunt and my great uncle and their ability or challenges in accessing the services that we administer, the benefits that define our nation, and how would they be able to navigate through the offers and the rights and the responsibilities that U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services administers. And I will tell you, my great aunt and uncle, despite years working here in the States, one as a seamstress and one as a machinist, would find it very difficult to navigate their way through a line, through some forms. Their facility with English was rather challenged. They spoke not a Cuban Spanish, but they spoke a fluent Spanish, and they spoke many other languages given their very long and winding journey to the States. And I think of them as I review our agency, and I try to develop, along with tremendous leadership in our agency, try to develop a footprint for the future in making sure that our definition of a nation as one of immigrants is actually the definition of a nation in the future as well. When I think of myself as, to use the word that Doris termed, a steward of the agency, I think of somebody else and somebody with whom I have only recently made an acquaintance, and that is Doris herself. Because though we have known each other for only a short period of time, the impression on me is a deep and broad one and a forever lasting one. Because in thinking of our conversations, in thinking of the thoughts and the wisdom that Doris has shared with me, I have a foundation of integrity that I hope to build upon and give honor to as I lead the agency. And so, Doris, I want to thank you, and I want to thank the Migration Policy Institute for hosting me and all of us today. We as an agency have a remarkably fundamental mission. It strikes at the core, as I mentioned, of the definition of our country. And it is an honor, it is a privilege, and it is a responsibility to carry forth that mission. And really what I want to do, if somebody asked me to sum up what I hope to accomplish during my tenure, it is to really reconnect the day-to-day life that we live within our agency to our fundamental mission. It is to ensure that the mission and the purpose and what we do and why we do it is uppermost in everyone's mind throughout the agency as we carry forward whatever it is that our job descriptions call for. It is remarkable what we can do when indeed we have our mission, our underlying mission, uppermost in our minds. And I think recently our tremendous work in extending humanitarian relief to individuals in Haiti and to Haitian nationals here in the United States is a very strong and compelling example of that. What we were able to accomplish in a short period of time to unite orphans in Haiti with their adoptive families here in the United States, the way we have with tremendous speed and agility extended temporary protected status to Haitian nationals here in the United States, the way we were able to reach across the country more than 17,000 individuals and organizations interested and invested in the relief effort I think, speaks volumes of the capacity of our agency, the dedication and spirit of our people, and what it is we can do if indeed we have our mission, if we live our mission on a daily basis. One of the things that we have done to ensure that, in fact, our mission is a part of our daily life is we set up early on in my tenure the Office of Public Engagement. And the term, the name of the office is very important because it was very purposeful. We were able to reach 17,000 constituents or customers. It's a word I don't particularly like. It speaks of a buy-sell transaction, and our work is more fundamental than that. But we were able to reach that diverse a group of people across the country through our Office of Public Engagement. It is not a part of our Office of Communications. It is not a part of our Office of Legislative Affairs. It is a separate and freestanding Office of Public Engagement. In order for us as a public service agency to serve the public, and it is a very diverse public, we must engage with the public. We must engage with all of you. And that means sharing with you some of the things that we want to accomplish, some of the issues and challenges that we are confronting, to understand the issues and concerns that you have with respect to what we are doing or what we intend to embark upon, and really to have a dialogue to ensure that we are indeed connected with what our customers intend for us. And I do mean customers in the broadest sense. I speak of the diverse public that we serve. It is the farm worker in the Central Valley of California. It is the sophisticated high-tech company. It is the taxpayer that funds our refugee and asylum work and other aspects of our administration. It is those individuals in law enforcement and the general public that care deeply and live by our national security and the like. And so through that Office of Public Engagement, we, in the wake of the tragic January 12th earthquake in Haiti, we were able to converse and dialogue with the constituency that was most impacted. And it is a model that we will be replicating in every aspect of our work. Most recently, this past Thursday, in New York City, we engaged from our 800 call center about our customer service efforts. We stood up in an office realignment, an Office of Customer Service, the name of which I think reflects its mission. I have heard loud and clear from members of AILA, ABIL, ASIP, many other constituencies, that the 800 number, while providing much needed access to a certain portion of the population that we serve, is really not effective for other portions of it. And so what can we do about that? And so we stood up the Office of Customer Service to gain best practices from sister agencies throughout the government, to reach out to the private sector, to capitalize on what some of the best and the brightest companies, private companies or public companies, what they have done in reaching a customer base that exceeds 6 million people a year and that is as diverse as ours, and so that we can deliver on our mission most ably. We have done an extraordinary job in the last 2 years of reducing our processing time, something that was of acute interest to our public a number of years back when we suffered backlogs and we suffered processing times that really delayed the delivery of justice to immigrant benefit seekers. And we have accomplished a great deal in that regard. And I am a little bit concerned, and my concern is not abating, but escalating, that in the effort to improve upon processing times, we have put an emphasis on speed. And an emphasis on speed and an emphasis on processing times can be vulnerable to a dehumanizing process. And it is in the wake of that concern, and it is with that concern mounting, as I study the agency and I travel throughout communities, that I underscore the importance of reconnecting with our mission. I speak of the fact that I've traveled a bit. One of the first tours, if you will, and I mean that in the non-celebrity manner, trust me, as I toured Los Angeles, New York, El Paso, Chicago, one of the first subjects that I had to deal with the public whom we serve, is the prospect that our fees might have to be increased. And it is an extraordinarily unpopular subject, and rightfully so, given the fee increase that the community endured in 2007. But I engaged very openly, and I think very vigorously, with the communities throughout the country in the service of a few things. Number one, I felt it our obligation to communicate as soon as the prospect of a potential fee increase arose to inform the public so that the dialogue could begin then. And number two, given the potential for the preparation to begin, whatever that entailed, depending upon who the audience member was. And I have to say, I return to the image of my great aunt and uncle in Brooklyn when I speak of a potential fee rule that is now in the clearance process. Can I stand before my great aunt? Can I stand before my great uncle? Or would I have been able to? And let them know that the benefit that they were seeking the minute that they set foot in this country was going to become more expensive. Could I look at them eye to eye with integrity and know that we as an agency did everything possible to avoid that, understanding that a benefit is something that my great aunt and uncle were entitled to. It's interesting. When I first was named for this position, the philosophical question, the policy question that I received, and people said this would be the toughest question, policy question I receive, is an immigration benefit a right or a privilege? And I don't. Maybe I'm missing the issue, which is quite possible. But I don't find that to be a difficult a question at all. The law provides for a benefit, and therefore I find a benefit to be a right that happens to be a privilege to have. But it is that. And so am I able, in my mind's eye, am I able to think, to conjure up the relatives that built my family and for whom money was scarce, and am I able to speak of a price increase with integrity and with unflinching integrity? And that therefore has, what it has caused is a review within our agency, a scrupulous review of our expenses, of how we spend immigrants' money, of our efficiencies, and whether we are indeed as efficient as we should be, so that we can, in fact, stand up before the public should a fee increase be necessary and say it is indeed necessary and we must do it. One of the, in the agency realignment, we also created an Office of Performance and Quality. The metrics which guided us, which guided our performance, were to a great extent numerically based, quantitative metrics. And to the extent that justice delayed is justice denied, quantity matters. To the extent that the delay in an administration of a benefit delays someone's ability to work and earn a living, speed matters. But how much are the fundamentals of our mission, how much are they realized in the performance work plans of our workforce? How much do they infuse the daily culture within our agency? And so our Office of Performance and Quality is focused right now on ensuring that the reconnection to our mission of which I speak is not just rhetoric, but is actually operational in nature, so that individual adjudicators will be evaluated in terms of their ability to deal with the customers whom we serve. Are we a welcoming agency? Are we an embracing agency? Do we extend a helping hand to an individual who is seeking a benefit to which that individual is entitled? And unless we, our performance metrics in the trenches, in the supervisorial ranks, throughout our agency, unless they reflect those basic tenets, those basic questions, then indeed the effort to reconnect to our mission or to prioritize our mission in the day-to-day life of our agency will be empty, albeit well-meaning, words. It is a daunting task, but all of the challenges that are worthwhile tend indeed to be daunting. And we have worked very ably with our union, of which I am very proud, to make sure that we are collectively involved in the effort. I am asked as well, Ali, how can you speak of a welcoming agency, of an embracing agency, when you also have a core fraud detection and national security mission? A mission the importance of which I hope to have elevated in the creation of a fraud detection and national security directorate devoted exclusively to that work. And that, too, I must say, is a I find to be an easy question to answer initially. The ability to protect the integrity of our system, the ability to detect, to prevent, to detect, to deter, to address fraud, the ability to ensure that individual or group of individuals who are not entitled to benefits, who would, if they could receive a benefit, wish to do us harm, the ability to address that effectively and vigorously allows us to extend a welcoming and helpful and embracing hand to those who deserve it. I've heard, as I've traveled around the country, I've heard of a concern that a culture of no permeates our agency, that we are want to hit the decline button if indeed we could, which would be candidly antithetical to the spirit of the agency of which I speak. And I mentioned this last week in one of our engagements with our stakeholders around the country, that I'm concerned that the vigilance that we correctly apply in the fraud detection and national security arena in the wake of September 11th has bled into the mind of the adjudicator, and understandably so, has bled into the adjudicative process when no longer fraud detection and national security are at issue, when we have resolved those concerns one way or the other, when no longer are we concerned about the danger that the individual poses, but rather we are only asking ourselves, is this individual entitled to the benefit? Have they met the qualifications? And have they been able to navigate the system? And so it's understandable how, with great vigilance, subconsciously, the minds of the adjudicators can be impacted when no longer is national security at issue. The shadow can loom large, and we're very focused on addressing that. One of the concerns that we have had, as we have discussed the state of our agency and what we hope its future to be, as we have discussed this with the public, is a concern that we are a bit of a patchwork of policies. I say policies, not regulations, advisedly. We're a patchwork of policies that are not always consistently administered. Sometimes policies don't prevail where they should. And one of the efforts that we have underway that I think speaks of the approach that we are going to have to our work, the engagement, not a listening session, not a talking to session, but the engagement, the interaction with one another that we are going to have, is we have collected all of our policies, all of our field guidance from across the country. We have gathered it all together, and we are going to be conducting a de novo review of those policies and the guidance to determine, does it reflect the values that we as an agency want to have now? Is it consistent? Do we have inconsistencies within our guidance and policy ranks? Does it accomplish what we want it to accomplish? Does it serve you, the public? We have begun that process. We revised our 648 form after hearing the concerns and the issues of the public, issuing a draft policy, engaging with the public on the draft, and going to print after having incorporated the feedback. We have embarked already on a fee waiver form, and we're going to be doing that across the board. And we look forward to the partnership with you in that endeavor, and frankly, in all of the work that we do. And if I can just end on that note, we will not govern by edict. We will not administer an immigration system that is in any way divorced from the public that we serve. Our goal is to build a partnership with you. Will we always get it right? Undoubtedly not. Will our intentions always be best? That, I can assure you as I stand before you, will indeed be the case. And we want to indeed carry forth our mission, serving the public. That is what we are, and I'm happy to answer whatever questions you, Doris, might pose and all of you might have. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, let me start then with where you just dropped off on this review of all of the agency's procedures and policies. In the first place, it has to have been quite a task to just gather them.
It was indeed. It was not a short process.
Exactly. And just how one defines procedures and policies and all of that sort of thing, I'm sure created some discussion in the staff offices. But I mean, that's a really fascinating and probably very overdue project because, you want me to use this? Overdue project because, as we all know, in large organizations, bureaucracies, things accumulate and they don't necessarily, and they're incremental and they don't necessarily taken together represent the things that might have been originally intended, and things then become contradictory and so on. So I certainly am fascinated, I think others would be, to get a little bit of a better idea of what that project is going to look like. I mean, what kind of a timeline do you think that it might be on? And do you have any, can you give any hints of the sorts of things that strike you, at least at the going in level, as possible problem areas or candidates for rethinking?
Thank you, Doris. I think what the public is going to see, I think if we try to accomplish that task at once, I would estimate we would finish sometime around the 12th of never.
Exactly.
And so what we need to do is we need to proceed in a prioritized fashion. And in the spirit of what I articulated and hopefully made clear, we are not going to define those priorities ourselves. What we are going to do is publish a survey that identifies all of the areas, categorically, all of the areas of policy that we have identified in the course of gathering together our guidance, and ask the public, what is the priority in which we should proceed? Understanding that our public is very, very diverse, and there will be certain policies of importance to certain constituencies that will not be important to others. I will tell you that what I hope to do in the next few weeks is actually put forth an overarching policy statement that captures the spirit of what I spoke of today, the spirit of the approach that we are going to have, our adjudication philosophy, if you will, and follow it with a memo speaking of the exercise of discretion, which I think is critical. And we'll be teeing up from the memorandum that you issued when you were the commissioner. I think it was in 1992 that spoke of the exercise of discretion when the agency was combined with ICE and in the Department of Justice. It, I think, is telling that that is the last formal iteration of a guidance memo on the exercise of discretion. We've had some follow-on to that. So what we hope to do is we're going to issue a survey to the public. We will develop the prioritization of our review, and we're going to do it in tranches of 10. Of course, the H-1B guidance is something that we are involved in now that was of acute interest to our adjudicators, asking for clarity, as well as the public.
Very good. And I'm happy to hear about the discretion effort. Actually, I think it was considered, it was a bit later than that. I think it was in the late 90s, but it still has been a very long time since there's been much discussion of that. You've talked about fees, and fees are obviously a very big issue for the agency. One of the things that happened with the last fee increase, which I think was in 2007, and you know, as you know, caused, I mean, there were some very considerable increases. It caused quite a bit of controversy. But one of the things that was associated with that fee is that it was explicitly for the purposes of both helping to pay the processing costs, but also to invest in infrastructure, which has been such a difficult arena for the immigration adjudications area for such a very long time. And that investment in infrastructure became known as the Transformation Initiative. I looked at your appropriations testimony from earlier last week, and the testimony says that the transformation. No project is more important than transformation, and I think many people in this room would subscribe to that, because this agency does need to be on much more of a modern footing in terms of its technology. But there have been delays. There have, by your own testimony, have not been much in the way of results. Can you talk to us about what you found where transformation was concerned when you arrived, and what it is that is being done at this point? Should we have confidence in this new technology transformation as the hopeful sign for the future? Give us the rundown on transformation.
Sure. Let me say this with respect to the confidence that all of you should have in transformation. I believe that confidence is earned. I think that what I'd like to do is show you empirically some things so that you develop confidence. I have a sense, given the history of transformation, and it certainly predates the latest iteration of the effort, I have a sense that if I ask you to have confidence in it, you would perhaps not give me an affirmative response. So I'm going to say this: we are extremely committed to it. What we have done now, and I think it is the model of undertaking a multi-year effort to really change the way the agency does business from top to bottom, side to side, I think we have precisely the correct approach, which is as follows. Develop the blueprint. Build plans before construction begins. Identify lessons learned from sister agencies and sister departments that have embarked upon this process. Other countries that have undertaken the effort to revamp their systems. Learn from that. Evaluate anew what the seed planting had done for us early on in the transformation effort. Look at our finances. Are we approaching it correctly? I think what we are doing right now is building those blueprints so that we can begin construction, and our hope is that you will see the results in 2011, if not earlier, with respect to certain non-immigrant categories. We had originally designed the architecture of transformation so that the first aspect of our work that would be transformed is citizenship. And that is at the back end of the process. And so we evaluated that in the context of our financial condition, in the context of really the flow and the progress of change, and what it involves in terms of bringing everyone along, not just the community, but our own workforce. And we changed the sequence. And so we're going to start with the non-immigrants. We hope to have results in the mid-year of 2011, if not sooner. But what we're doing now is we're building the foundation, and it's a multi-year effort. And we are very committed to it, and I think there is cause for confidence, and we'll earn your confidence in short order.
So if you start with non-immigrants, certain categories,
yes,
of non, do you have that determined yet?
I believe we do. I believe we're going to start in certain of the business categories, mm-hmm, first.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. One other thing then on transformation and fees. Theoretically, it has always been the understanding that if the agency could be efficient, as you've talked about, timely, obviously making good decisions, but with the kind of an infrastructure that allowed for timely and effective efficient processing, that ultimately your cost picture would begin to taper and arguably even be reduced. The opposite of that, obviously, is to look at a future of continuously increasing fees, and at a certain point,
that is not a very optimistic kind of a revenue picture to be looking at, particularly given the considerations you've talked about in terms of your customer base. Is that realistic? Is that theoretical idea that once you get enough automation, enough streamlining of business processes, that costs will at least stabilize, if not perhaps in some areas be reduced?
Doris, if we were true to the fee for services cost model, then fees should indeed decrease if our costs have decreased, if the modernization or transformation effort is a success and we gain tremendous efficiencies, which certainly is one of the goals. If indeed we accomplish that and we have paid for the cost of transformation, then arguably if we are true to the model, our fees should be reduced.
So that is still a possibility.
It is.
Okay.
But now we're speaking of quite a number of years out. The transformation effort is not an inexpensive one. As you correctly noted, our costs include the costs of infrastructure, improvements, and the like.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Okay. Let me take us to E-Verify, because there's a recent event where E-Verify is concerned, the WestEd evaluation.
Yes.
And so I'd like to give you an opportunity to talk about what the takeaways are from that evaluation. And then I'm going to ask you a follow-up question. But why don't you tell us what what the state of play is based on WestEd?
Sure. When I first arrived at the agency in August of 2009, the resounding concerns that I had heard about E-Verify were the following: that the work authorized were receiving tentative non-confirmations at a rate that was untenable. And the WestEd study that was published that captured data in the early 2009 timeframe speaks of the tremendous success of E-Verify in authorizing instantaneously new employees who are in fact work authorized. The accuracy rate in that category is above 99%. The concern has shifted now to E-Verify's ability to detect an individual who is not work authorized, the ability of E-Verify to detect that individual in the verification process. And the WestEd study, the reports of the WestEd study got the numerator right. They just didn't, I think, give appropriate deference to the denominator in the fraction. What the reports indicated that E-Verify was able to identify, was not able to identify the unauthorized worker 54% of the time. What is very important to note is that the population of unauthorized workers that come through the E-Verify system is 6.2% of the entire employee workforce that is vetted through E-Verify. And so E-Verify, according to the WestEd study, misses 54% of that 6.2% subset. And that's a much, much smaller community of people. And I would say two things about that. Number one, I think we can speak of the effectiveness of E-Verify in identifying that 6.2% denominator, because that to me speaks of a deterrent effect of the E-Verify system, number one. And number two, the WestEd study did indeed identify challenges that E-Verify has in detecting identity fraud. And I will tell you, as a federal prosecutor, that prosecuted identity fraud cases, not just in the immigration arena, but in many other areas, it is a crime that is difficult to address. And E-Verify is but one tool in our arsenal to address identity fraud. So I actually thought that the Westat study spoke of E-Verify's successes more so than it did underscore any particular challenge. It was a challenge of which we were aware.
Yeah, I think that's exactly fair. I mean, the E-Verify was never set up to check for identity fraud. I mean, it was set up to check for work authorization.
And we're doing a great job, and we are developing tools to address the identity fraud issue as well, which we've been working on. Some have been rolled out, and others are to come.
But, you know, the problem, as you know, is that ultimately, if this were to become a mandatory requirement, that identity fraud or that checking of identity is also critical in order to actually achieve the kind of workplace in which only legally authorized workers are working. So let me ask you about the idea du jour, which is that last week in the immigration blueprint that Senator Schumer and Graham laid out, they called now for a biometric Social Security card. What would be the implications of a provision like that for E-Verify?
Once that card is instituted and it is indeed, it does indeed capture biometrics, that would, of course, be a tremendous improvement in the ability to counter identity fraud. There's no question that a hard biometrics card, the more that we can capture biometrics on the front end, the greater security level we will have in the ability to identify an individual's work status. What I say really to critics of E-Verify, and I think it's an important point, is the following. Does E-Verify assist responsible corporate employers in ensuring the lawfulness of their workforce? What would the ability be absent the E-Verify tool? Is E-Verify foolproof? Does it capture identity fraud 100% of the time or anything approximating that type of perfection? No, it doesn't. It does a tremendous amount more than the absence of that tool would.
Okay, let's go to naturalization and another new area for USCIS, which is grant money and the ability to give grants. And I think the Congress authorized some of that funding for the first time this past year. And you're asking for it again this year. Could you tell us how it is that you see that grant capability vis-a-vis the naturalization mission that the agency has?
Absolutely. And so last year, in fiscal year 2009, we administered $1.2 million in grants. It was our first appropriation for that purpose, and we extended grants to 13 different organizations throughout the country. This year, we will be extending grants of approximately $7 million to a greater number of organizations around the country. And the purposes are twofold. One is to bring to people who do not have access already the tools to enable them to naturalize, to develop the civic knowledge, the facility with English. We as an agency, through our Office of Citizenship, have programs in place, but there's nothing that can substitute capacity building. And so to enable people to pass the naturalization test, these grants will assist in that endeavor. Of equal importance is, once naturalized, what is our ability to extend a helping hand to welcome these new citizens into the fabric of our society and have them enjoy the rights and assume the responsibilities that they voluntarily have become entitled to. And so much of our funding will be dedicated to immigrant integration programs. I think it serves the immigrant community well. It serves our nation very well in that we are bringing into the day-to-day life of our country active participants in our democracy. I also think that it strengthens our national security. Individuals who indeed are integrated into our communities, it prevents the type of isolation and the things that isolation can create. And I think it really it speaks to our mission of welcoming and embracing the immigrant.
I'm going to ask you one final question, and then we're going to go to audience Q&A, so get ready with your questions. My final question has to do more broadly with USCIS vis-a-vis other agencies, intra-agencies and intra-agency and inter-agency. I mean, obviously, a great deal of what goes on in your agency and under your responsibility depends on effective coordination across other lines. I mean, with the FBI, for instance, on name checks, with the courts on administrative proceedings, etc., and some of it also within DHS. I'm thinking of the trial attorneys that are at ICE and under ICE's jurisdiction, even though they do cases that both arise from ICE and from USCIS. Could you talk to us about that intra and interagency landscape at this point, where you run up against obstacles because of the complexity across agency lines, what it is that might be happening that is helping to improve the kind of coordination that must exist because of the large number of players that are now in place?
If I can just share, Doris, with you and everyone here, a thought that I had when I began scrubbing our financial situation. This will speak of the interagency relationship. When I came to the agency, I had thoughts of how to recognize outstanding employees and to reward them and compensate them for stellar performance. And lo and behold, little did I know that I walk into an agency that's broke. And that not only will we not be able to do that, but in this terrible economy, we are going to be turning to the public and informing them that their prices might go up. And so the vigilance, the economic efficiency vigilance, the unflinching rigor that requires, led me to look at our interagency, interdepartmental relationships. And I remember when I was the U.S. attorney, somebody in the executive office of U.S. attorneys told me, if you want to know something about your agency's stature, follow the money. And so I remembered that, and I followed the money. And what we are is a check-writing agency, very seldom a check-receiving agency. We pay for services that we obtain, and we don't charge for services that we provide. So a word of caution to my sister agencies and departments, the bill is in the mail. But what I have found is we have very long-lasting and institutionally strong relationships with certain departments. And we have some that are functional, that I would describe as suboptimal, that seemed to be driven by solutions to problems when the problems arise, as opposed to collaboratively building an architecture to prevent the problems from ever arising. And that is a project that is underway, and there is no substitute. There's no substitute for individual attention to that and the nurturing of the relationship. I will tell you, it's a reminder to me. I've forgotten about this aspect of being in the government, that there is a tendency sometimes to be siloed rather than to look at the government as truly one public service agency with many different responsibilities. And I think our secretary, Secretary Napolitano, deserves tremendous credit because it is having real life impact on developing a one DHS model for our department, which is new and which is a collection of agencies that have some symbioses and some tensions, but trying to build that and build it through communication. We have some issues I don't mean that in a pejorative way. We have some questions that we must answer together with the Department of Labor. There is no substitute to being able to answer those questions collaboratively than to have our Chief Counsel, Roxy Bacon, be able to pick up the phone and speak with her counterpart at the Department of Labor and create that type of collaborative relationship. And so we are very focused on it. It'll be interesting to see how the focus on friendship couples with the focus on creditor-debtor relationship to which I referred. But it requires work. It requires work to a surprising degree.
Okay, with that, I'm going to open the floor for questions. And there is a mic that will be traveling around, so give Lisa just a moment to get to you. Hands? Okay, right there. Please tell us who you are.
Henry Bratley. My question goes to the financials you just mentioned. You inherited an agency that was broke. There's significant decrease in fees. Do you believe that barring an increase in the fees that you're going to have enough to do transformation of facilities and other things that are in need for the next 3 years?
A transformation, the project, I don't know if was everybody able to hear the question. Let me repeat it, if I might. I spoke of an agency that was broke when I inherited. It's really a function of the fact that fiscal year 2009 witnessed a tremendous drop-off in revenue, and we have a considerable amount of fixed costs. Would we be able to fund our operations absent a fee increase? There are three ways that we get through a financially troubling times, given our fixed expenses. One is to make cuts, and we have been implementing approximately $160 million in cuts. We are mindful of the fact that we do not want to cut to such a degree that we impair the service that we actually want to improve upon. And so those cuts we have been underway in making and implementing. Two is to seek a greater appropriation. And three is to propose a fee rule. And I spoke at in testimony last week about the fact that a draft fee rule is in the clearance process now. We need something to bridge where we are now and where we need to be to fund our operations on a going forward basis.
Hi, I'm Nancy Cleland with the NLRB. You spoke early on about reconnecting the mission of the agency with your daily life. And I'm just curious, how would you describe the mission yourself in your own words?
The mission of our agency is to enable people who are entitled to receive a benefit, to enable them to receive it in a way that does honor to our nation as one of immigrants, and that does honor to the underlying reason why we are a nation of immigrants, proud to accept new citizens. That distinguishes us from other countries who do not encourage citizenship. That's a quick off-the-cuff mission statement.
Pretty eloquent. Hands in the front.
I'm Paul Mayani. I'm an attorney here in Washington, and perhaps your major groupie. I seem to come to all of your things or be on the phone with them. I have two comments, one that follows up on what you just said. You've said twice now that you believe that if you qualify for the benefits, it's a right. I am disturbed in a way that one of the first policy things you're looking at is Doris Meisner's prosecutorial discretion memo, because I think that belongs over in John Morton's shop in ICE. I think that in a lot of what you need to do now and in transformation is have less discretion, because I think there's a lot of discretion to say no. When someone meets the criteria for a benefit, that should be it. It should be granted. So I'm sort of intrigued that it's a prosecutorial discretion memo that you're looking at.
Well, I didn't use the term prosecutorial.
Well, that's the only, but the memo does. Doris's does.
Well, I'm going to build on that memo. but that is a memo that was written when the agency was the Immigration
exactly.
and Naturalization
yeah.
Service. I could not disagree with you more with respect to discretion. And I have to tell you, I was a federal prosecutor for 12 years. And therefore for 12 years was a public interest lawyer. And in the administration of justice, which is what we as an agency do, not everything is black and white. And to deprive us of the ability to exercise discretion can have untold consequences on an individual who might be entitled to a benefit, where there are certain equities that may play, that should be considered. I will fight to continue to exercise discretion as vigorously as possible. Remember something, justice is only as good as the individual in whose hands it rests. I will tell you, I have prosecuted many a bank robber. And I can share with you a case that I handled of a bank robber who I would want to sentence, if I were the judge, I was the prosecutor, so I recommended a sentence as long as I possibly could, and I challenged my arithmetic under the sentencing guidelines to be able to propose as long a sentence as possible. And then I encountered, but 3 months later, a young bank robber who I felt had never had in his young life a chance to develop a human spirit, and who I sensed in that person a spirit that was gasping for air. And unfortunately, that individual encountered the criminal justice system rather than a social service agency. And I wanted to employ discretion within the bounds of the law to be able to recommend a sentence to a judge that captured the lack of opportunity that that individual had. You know, deferred action. Is that not an exercise of discretion?
Absolutely.
Would you want us to be deprived of that?
No.
My memo will follow.
But you're still talking about what seems to be in John Morton's shop mostly. But I'll wait for the memo and see the discretion to get to yes, which is certainly what we're interested in. If there,
well, you know, discretion to get to yes can be as pernicious as a discretion to get to no. It's supposed to be discretion to get to right.
Sorry, move over here. My name is Aaron McCready. I work for the Arlington County Department of Human Services and Community Outreach Program. And actually, we work very closely with USCIS, particularly the Prosperity Avenue site. And I had numerous questions like she would, but I think I'll pick my one question to ask. Knowing that the USCIS and your predecessors have done a great job of doing internal and external stakeholder meetings, and that a lot of experts on the ground level have a lot of great ideas. My question is, you know, how much of the changes, the things that you can implement on a larger scale, how many of those ideas would you think come out of those meetings, and how much communication happens with that?
As much as possible would be my if I were to. Be committed to answering your question in one sentence, as much as possible. We came to the, we embarked upon our public engagement effort. We heard two things from the community initially. We heard that individuals who were due to an impairment or incapacity, individuals were unable to get through the naturalization process. And we heard about our checkered 648 form history. And we heard about the fact that fee waivers, that we weren't reaching the poor because we didn't have a fee waiver form, nor did we have a consistent process in place. Well, we engaged with our community on the 648. We're very proud of the fact that the 648 form that is in process now reflects the concerns and issues and desires of the community. We are engaging now to develop our fee waiver form so we bring consistency to bear. Consistency is something to which our public is entitled. We're engaging on our H-1B memo. The skilled worker. We have engaged very vigorously now on that. We're going to have a second engagement. The community has raised certain issues. We're taking a look at them. Concern has been expressed that we may have had some unintended consequences with respect to medical practitioners. We're meeting with medical practitioners. We're opening up the lines with the nationwide, with people interested in that issue. Lord knows I've read the Darden decision, the Clackamas decision, the relevant CFR. We mean what we say. We're fully engaged. Doris asked, what is this policy review going to be? What's it going to mean? In what order will we be proceeding? You will define that order along with our adjudicators, who also need clarity and consistency. And by the way, discretion is not unfettered, it is guided. I think that is one of the very important messages of Doris's memo, that there are principles that guide the exercise of discretion. It's not a football field without goalposts. That is when problems arise. But it is core principles that reflect the values of our agency so that the exercise of discretion can achieve those values in an environment that is all too often gray.
Okay, last question. Mark?
Thanks, Liz. Mark Schlackman with Florida State University. How are you, sir? I would just
like to ask you a broad brush question, doing a quick analogy to what just unfolded in Washington on a totally different front, the healthcare related debate, and then just looking at it from a process perspective and then coming back to this subject matter. Do you believe that the conventional interagency process to weigh in terms of helping to set the factual predicate for a change in law and policy is sufficient to offset or to counterbalance what seemed to be, in terms of the healthcare, a range of competing factual predicates, many of which had no basis in reality? And if you look, or seemingly so, if you look at the visceral reaction to healthcare and then come back to immigration, we've seen it cyclically, there are many constituencies that wouldn't fall into your stakeholder and informed stakeholders and informed constituents, just I'll call it broad brush mainstream, that are traveling forward with different facts. And then you have the Tancredos of the world and others to spin up a lot of angst. So I guess to come back to a question, is the conventional interagency way of supporting this kind of change whenever comprehensive immigration reform gains traction, does that give an agency like USCIS enough of the voice to try to shape some of these realities?
I wasn't expecting a metaphysical question to conclude our. Can I rephrase the question a bit so that it's one that I, you know, can manage? The question is, if I understand it, Mark, is the interagency dialogue, is the interagency conversation sufficiently robust such that, number one, we are able as a government to define a set of facts that serve as the predicate for problem solving, so we understand what the problem it is that we're trying to solve. And number two, do we as an agency have a sufficiently strong voice in the development of the solution? Is that?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Rashomon was a classic movie for a reason. People can see one event seven different ways. And hopefully what comes out of a discussion in the interagency, and not just in the interagency, for us to have a discussion about discretion, for you and I to talk about mass migration issues, people are going to come. I don't know that uniformity is always a correct goal. There's a common understanding of the parameters of the issue. In the context of immigration policy and the need for immigration reform, a particular publicly traded company is going to view the problem potentially differently than a farm worker who's interested in gaining status or some stability. And so I don't know that there is one definition to a problem, but there has to be some common ground. And number two, with respect to the strength of our agency, I think that our agency hopefully is growing in stature. I have to tell you that from the point of view of our ability to send missionaries into the interagency, into the interdepartmental, we could not be in a stronger place. I look at the people in the first row and elsewhere in the room on behalf of our agency, on behalf of our department. Brendan and I, we're in an interagency discussion on a very significant national security issue. I couldn't be more proud to have the seat next to him. Our stature will only be improving. And I will tell you, Somebody asked me to define our mission. Let me, if I can, define the mission for 2010 in a certain way for our agency and conclude on this point. My mission as a leader of the agency, or as one of the leaders of the agency, I should say, is to bridge the gap between our reputation and the quality of the people that we have. Because when we take a look at the tragedy of Haiti, when we take a look at some of the difficult cases that come along, and we see how people respond to the difficult cases, the big challenges that are public, those that are not public, that are private, that are that present potential tragedies or real tragedies just as compellingly for a particular family or a particular individual. I'm immensely proud of what we see in our agency. And we do not have a particularly great reputation, and we will, and we're going to earn it.
Well, thank you very, very much for being with us and for this part of earning it. It's been a very enlightening session, and I'm sure I speak on behalf of everybody in wishing you all the very best with them.
Thank you.
For more information, visit the Migration Policy Institute at www.migrationpolicy.org.